From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For more than 50 years, John Hope Franklin has been writing the history of African Americans, a history that had previously been ignored or filled with misconceptions. On this edition of Fresh Air, John Hope Franklin talks about his research and the racial inequalities he faced himself along the way. Also today, we meet the man who has everything, including the wrong haircut, rocker Ben Vaughn. World music commentator Milo Miles considers how punk rock has influenced Japanese music. And critic Maureen Corrigan has some suggestions on how to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Associated Press reporter Terry Anderson has now been held hostage in Lebanon for 5 years. Friends and family of Anderson, including his sister Peggy Say, marked the anniversary today with a rally near the White House. In an exclusive interview today with National Public Radio, President Bush spoke about Anderson and his sister's efforts to win his release. NPR's Jim Engel reports.
The president told NPR Peggy Say is a courageous woman who has suffered for 5 long years.
I just got thinking that Barbara and I would like to hold her hand and say, stay with it. You're courageous and we respect you.
The president said he must be careful not to give the hostage holders a signal. They have more advantage in holding the hostages than in releasing them. Officials have been wary of meetings between the president and hostage families for fear hostage takers might be encouraged to think they can influence U.S. policy. The president said today he's trying to express concern for the hostages without sending that signal to the kidnappers.
You don't overdo public comments. You don't have too many dramatic meetings or public call public attention to this.
That, the president said, is a delicate balance. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
East German candidates and their West German backers today entered the final race to catch votes for weekend elections. The elections are expected to establish the first non-communist government in the state's 40-year history. Analysts expect an extremely high turnout at Sunday's polls for the first free and secret elections since East Germany was formed as a Soviet satellite some 40 years ago. Voters will choose among 24 parties and alliances. Talks between the South African government and the African National Congress will begin next month. According to a statement released by President F.W. de Klerk today, NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
De Klerk said the talks will start on April 11th. He will lead the government delegation of cabinet ministers, and Nelson Mandela will lead the ANC group. The last time the two men met, Mandela was a life prisoner. But this time, Mandela will head a delegation of ANC officials that will include exiled leaders of the ANC, as well as some recently released prisoners. The discussions are regarded as talks about talks. They will revolve around what are considered the remaining obstacles to full negotiations for a new constitution. The main obstacles the ANC has pointed to are the continuing state of emergency and the continuing imprisonment of political prisoners, including those who were convicted of crimes involving violence. If these issues can be resolved, the real negotiations will begin. But the political disturbances around the country that have resulted in a rising death toll could interfere with the progress of the discussions. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street today, stock prices were higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 45.5 points to close at 2741.22. Advances led declines 3-1. This is NPR. The Grumman Corporation pleaded guilty today to illegally obtaining secret Air Force budget documents and was ordered to pay $2.5 million in fines and penalties. Grumman's plea makes it the fourth defense contractor since November to plead guilty to illegal trafficking of Pentagon documents. The company admitted that it obtained two secret Air Force documents through a former employee. The close of the Soviet Central Committee meeting in Moscow ends a week of dramatic changes in Soviet politics. Since Sunday, the Communist Party has given up its leading political role, and Mikhail Gorbachev has been appointed the country's first executive president. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports.
It was probably inevitable that in a week when the Soviet Communist Party had been forced to relinquish so much authority, today's plenum would be a stormy affair. Debate was dominated by traditionally hardline members of the Central Committee. Vadim Medvedev, who's worked closely with Mr. Gorbachev over the last few months, said both he and many others had come in for criticism. Besides this, much of today's discussion had revolved around the next party congress, now set for July the 2nd. It would be preceded by a meeting of the Russian Federation Party, he said, but did not indicate whether a separate Russian Communist Party was to be set up, as some people have suggested. He did reveal, however, that delegates to the party congress would be elected by secret ballot and direct elections, a victory for the party's reformers, who are trying hard to ensure representatives of the congress will be democratically elected in a desperate attempt to revive the party's authority.
Bridget Kendall reporting from Moscow. The American head of the World Health Organization's global program on AIDS quit today. Dr. Jonathan Mann resigned in a policy dispute with the agency's director general. Mann said in a letter that there were too many differences between himself and the agency head over running the $100 million a year program. Brazil's new president today began implementing measures aimed at tackling his country's economic problems. The measures come one day after his inauguration. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Hope Franklin is one of America's foremost historians. As a pioneer in the field of African-American history, he's investigated the roots of racism in America. As an African-American scholar, he's had to personally overcome that racism. Franklin became the first black man to head the history departments at Brooklyn College and the University of Chicago, the American History Association, and the Organization of American Historians. His area of specialization has been Southern history, and his books include the groundbreaking 1947 work From Slavery to Freedom, A History of Negro Americans. As for Franklin's personal history, he grew up in a small town in Oklahoma. His father was a lawyer, his mother a teacher. Franklin's grandparents were born into slavery, but either escaped or were freed as teenagers. A collection of Franklin's essays from 1938 to 1988 has just been published. It's called Race and History. He told me some of the misconceptions about America's past that inspired him to write history.
The genteel master, the obsequious slave, the happy house servant, and all the rest. I found that there was a great discrepancy between the accepted views about that and actual facts. It's very important from my point of view, not merely that the record be set in terms of the role of blacks, but also in terms of the role of whites. For whites misunderstand their own history, misread their own history. And as they do, they bring into the 20th century, toward the end of the 20th century, notions about the relationships of blacks and whites, notions about their own position, notions about the position of blacks that interfere with any kind of real understanding of the problems which we face in 1990.
Were there preconceptions when you started becoming a scholar yourself about the ability of a black to be a scholar?
Yes. Well, there were all kinds of reservations which even the great universities had about blacks, despite the fact that W.E.B. Du Bois went to Harvard University back in the early 90s and got his Ph.D. in 1896, and his work on the suppression of the African slave trade was the first volume of the Harvard Historical Studies. When I arrived at Harvard in 1935, The fact that I was, even after I made the grades and sometimes better than the white graduate students, I was quite aware of the fact that I did not become and did not have the opportunity to become a teaching assistant, that is, to be close to the professor, to grade papers, and that sort of thing. Instead of making me a teaching assistant, I was given a fellowship in which I didn't have to do any work. That is, I could stay out of the classroom and stay in the library. And in one way, it was an advantage, but it was in another way, I knew quite well that it was for the purpose of keeping me away from a student-teacher relationship with the Harvard undergraduates.
You were often in the position of researching segregation or researching slavery in libraries and archives that were segregated.
Yes.
Give us an example of some of the obstacles you faced there.
Well, when I arrived in North Carolina in the spring of 1939 to do research on free Negroes in North Carolina in the State Department of Archives and History, I went in to see the director of the archives one morning, one Monday morning, and told him that I was there to do research and I wanted to examine certain manuscripts and so forth. And he said, well, very frankly, when we built this building, we had no idea that anyone of your color would ever be coming here to do research, and therefore we don't have any facilities for you. Then he paused, and I looked at him. He said, but I suppose that you have a right to be here, and the only thing I ask you to do is to give me some time, during which time I can make some arrangements. He said, give me a week. Well, I was down there paying room rent and paying for my meals, and I thought that was a long time just to loaf around at my expense. And I just looked straight at him, and he knew, I suppose, what I was thinking, and he said, well, how about 3 days? And I said, well, I'll be back. And I went back at the end of the morning of the fourth day, and they had all things arranged. They had removed all of the materials out of a small display room that was used by the historical division of the archives. And they had put in there a table and a chair. And the search room was across the hall where all of the whites were doing their research and where the card catalog and all that were. And I was presented with a key to the manuscript stacks. And that was the understanding, of course, that the white attendants would not bring things to me, and therefore I would have to get them myself. Well, I would cross the hall, go into the search room, and go stick my key in the locked manuscript stacks and go in and come out with a wagon load of marvelous materials, and the whites would stop and look at me. And after 2 weeks of this, the director of the archives called me in and said, I'm sorry, but I'll have to take your key. I said, what's wrong? I didn't. What have I done? He said, it is not that you have done anything. It is that all of the other people who are doing research here are demanding keys also, so that they can go into the stacks and have the privilege that you are enjoying. I said, they are being discriminated against, I suppose they would say. He said, that's what they said to me. And so he lifted my key, and then he said, well, I will have to require the attendants now to deliver the materials to you. And so from that day on, I would merely go over to the person who had charge of the reading room, the manuscript reading room, turn in my requests for manuscripts, then retreat to my little room and wait there until the manuscripts were brought to me by attendants who I suppose would have brought them anyway at the outset.
Historian John Hope Franklin is my guest, and he has a new book of collected essays from 1938 to 1988, and the book is called Race and History. You said that your parents wouldn't stand for segregation when you were growing up. I mean, what did that mean exactly? Were there public places that they wouldn't go to because they didn't want to have to go to the segregated area?
Oh, yes. Neither my mother nor my father ever voluntarily segregated themselves. My father was a lawyer, as you know, and he would not tolerate segregation in the courthouse in Tulsa. When he took me to court with him, which was very often. After all, don't forget that I'm trying to apprentice as a lawyer at that point. And he would never permit me to sit where blacks were supposed to sit or expected to sit. I either sat, if it was a non-jury case, I sat in one of the seats where the jury would ordinarily be seated, or if it was a jury case, I sat at the bar at the desk table with my father, and he simply wouldn't stand for it. Now, we lived in a city that was absolutely and completely segregated. There was not just, it was separate. It wasn't just segregation. For example, there were no movie houses in which there were white sections and black sections. There were white movie houses and black movie houses. And the same thing was true of virtually everything else. The only place that I know where there was segregation of an audience was at the convention hall. There was only one such auditorium in the city. And it was to this hall that, say, the Paul Whiteman came with the orchestra and accompanied by George Gershwin, and I think it was 26 or 27. And it was to this hall that the Chicago Civic Opera Company performed every spring. My mother and father would not even consider going to such places. But I was a music buff, and so I wanted to go. They said, well, you go on your own. We wouldn't go. But there were other blacks in the city that would go, and I would go with them.
Did you feel bad about going, that you were violating a family principle?
The family principle really was that one could do as one pleased at this. There was, in other words, there was permissiveness, because my parents did not think that this was an absolute cardinal sin, as it were. But it was a principle for them, which they did not insist that the children pursue. But I do, even now, at times reproach myself, despite the fact that I'm still an opera buff and was on the board of the Chicago Symphony for a number of years. The reason that I like this is because I experienced the humiliation of segregation in order to develop these tastes, and I don't think that's very pretty.
Historian John Hope Franklin is my guest, and he has a new book of selected essays from 1938 to 1988. It's called Race and History. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is historian John Hope Franklin. You know, some of your essays in your new book, you talk about some of the obstacles that you've faced as a black scholar, and you write that there's really, it goes beyond any discrimination you faced in the field itself. For instance, when you were the chairman of the history department at Brooklyn College, one of the problems you had was finding a house you wanted to live in, because you weren't, a lot of neighborhoods just refused to sell to you.
That's right. That's right. I spent more than a year trying to find a place to purchase. This after my appointment there was of such spectacular nature that my picture and a long article about the appointment was on the front page of the New York Times. But when I set out to find a house near the college, I hoped that I would be able to walk to work. Almost no real estate dealers in the area would show me any of the houses that they were widely advertising. And when I finally found one offered by the owner, then I had the problem of trying to find the money to borrow to purchase a house. And that was another round of excruciating experiences. I finally found it, but I could have spent all this time much better.
Let me ask you a kind of stupid question. Did you ever take that front page article with you to the realtors and say, look, do you know who I am?
No. No, I don't believe in that. I think that I'm a human being, and that ought to be enough to come. And I'm well-mannered, and I'm fairly well-dressed, and my conduct is, I hope, above reproach. And I think that ought to commend me. If that doesn't, well, I'm sure that they don't want to hear anything about who I am. I have no doubt that many of these people knew who I was, and yet I was still rejected.
You know, it strikes me that for black Americans who haven't entered the middle class that these are particularly hard times. I wonder if you share that observation.
Yes. Let me say, first of all, that there are hard times for all black Americans still. In one way or another, most black Americans, whether they are at the top of the economic scale or at the bottom, are reminded who they are. And that's one thing that we have to live with. I was in New York a few weeks ago and was reminded. I've been reminded in so many ways within the past year. But, of course, people at the lower end of the economic scale suffer more than people at other points on the economic scale. They suffer not merely the indignities of discrimination and whatnot, but they suffer because they do not have the opportunity and cannot seize the opportunity, have no way to seize the opportunity, to qualify for anything but the most menial jobs and to qualify for anything but welfare and that sort of thing. What's so tragic is that the discrimination is pervasive and is generational. By that I mean that it goes down from one generation to another on both sides of the of our communications, that is white and black, so that in 1990 there are literally thousands and thousands of blacks who are unemployed and whose fathers were unemployed. And when you get to that point, the starkness of the tragedy seems to be so clear.
Well, do you think that people in that position sometimes give up on the culture and think that there won't ever be anything there for them?
Of course, of course. We have large numbers of people, I think, who've given up. It can be seen in the, if one goes into certain parts of the city, Washington or Philadelphia or New York or San Francisco, and you can see the hopelessness and the helplessness on the faces and on the conduct of and in the conduct of many of these people. The whole underground economy, drug and alcohol abuse, all of those things are manifestations of hopelessness. They aren't shooting up for just because they are having fun, but because they're in despair. And I don't think there's any mistake about it. And the number of people who are unemployed and who are in that position is larger than we are led to believe by the statistics which are provided, I think. After all, we must remember that when we speak of unemployment, we speak of unemployment in terms of the people who are in the labor market who are seeking employment. But some of these people that we're talking about now are not in that market, not in the labor market, and therefore they are not counted even as unemployed.
Do you often ask yourself what your contribution to the present, to the kinds of problems you're talking about now, can be as a historian, as a scholar?
Of course. Never a day passes but what I don't ask myself, what can I do? It's not enough to write race and history or any of the other 11 or 12 books that I've written. It's not enough even to teach in the great universities, as it's been my privilege to do. It's not enough to communicate one's ideas in any formal didactical sense. What one needs to do, and I say this to my students and to my friends, one needs to be an activist, One needs to do something about illiteracy. One needs to do something about these other tragic modes of conduct that we see. I'm always insisting now that if the university and if the college have been ivory towers, they cannot afford to be in our society as it is now. After having taught for 53 years, perhaps it might be difficult for me to turn to some of these more activist activities, although I hasten to add that I have done some of all of that throughout my life. I would to myself like to renew my own activities and increase them. And I call on all young people of all races and of all ethnic groups to join in, for this world is no better than the least of the people in it.
You've written about the desperate need for more black teachers. Is there a shortage of black teachers, and if so, why do you think that is?
Well, there's, a shortage in the sense that not only the numbers are a few, but they are decreasing. It has been estimated by some that if the rate of decrease persists, the black teacher will almost have disappeared by the year 2000. That's only 10 years from now. Well, of course, the number of blacks in graduate school, first the number of blacks in high school, the number of blacks in college is decreasing. And this is particularly true of black males, much more so than of black females, but it's true of both. There was developed, as a result of the closed doors, there developed a great tradition of teaching among blacks. And that tradition is disappearing because of the decline in numbers. I think that the total numbers and the decline in those numbers explain part of it. And the options to go elsewhere to do other things helps also to explain the lack of black teachers.
What research are you in the middle of doing now? What historical research?
I'm working on a book which I hope will correct some of those distortions and errors that we talked about at the beginning. I'm working on a book on runaway slaves, and it has to do with the breakdown in the relationship between masters and slaves, and the result being that slaves simply absconded for a variety of reasons. But it's that point of the breakdown of the relationship that I'm examining now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
John Hope Franklin has been my guest, the historian who is currently a professor at Duke University. His latest book is a book of selected essays from 1938 to 1988 called Race and History. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ben Vaughan's record collection spans the history of rock and roll. So does his own music. Coming up, getting back to the roots of rock and roll with songwriter, singer, and guitarist Ben Vaughan. Also, world music critic Milo Miles plays some music by two Japanese bands influenced by punk rock. And commentator Maureen Corrigan recommends some reading for St. Patrick's Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Calls continue today for the release of all the hostages held in Lebanon on the fifth anniversary of the kidnapping of American journalist Terry Anderson. Anderson has been held the longest of any Western hostage, and his sister Peggy Say called on his captors asking once again that he be set free.
We are the American people. And you have humiliated us, and you have degraded us, and you have shamed us, and you have beaten and killed us, and you have angered us. And you wonder why your claims of injustice fall on deaf ears.
Say spoke in a park across from the White House where friends and supporters gather today. Earlier, she met at the White House with President Bush. In an interview with National Public Radio, the president said that he thinks of the hostages in Beirut with a heavy heart, and he pledged to work for their release. Mr. Bush said he wants to express concern without sending an encouraging signal to the kidnappers.
There's a delicate balance here. You don't do, you don't overdo public comments. You don't have too many dramatic meetings or call public attention to this. But you, on the other side of the equation, if you feel something in your heart, then you try to respond with compassion and understanding. It's delicate.
And the president said today that he has been in contact with Syrian President Assad about the hostages, but he's not able to share any words of optimism. The trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter continued today in Washington, with the defense for the first time seeking to portray Poindexter's reluctant accuser, Oliver North, as a man who does not tell the truth. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
North, who just a few months ago said that Poindexter was, quote, the only one who didn't hang Ollie North out to dry, in the end proved a damaging, albeit reluctant, witness against his former boss. North, in his testimony, linked Poindexter to almost every act charged in the five-count indictment against the former National Security Advisor. And so today, defense lawyer Richard Beckler began a clear process of trying to undermine North's credibility. Beckler, cross-examining former White House aide Ron Sable, got Sable to concede that North had misled him on occasion. What was your opinion of Oliver North? Asked the defense lawyer. He was a guy, said Sable, who, if you wanted to get to the other side of the wall, would get you there first, but he might not check to see if there was a door. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up 45.5 points to close at 2,741.22 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. World music commentator Milo Miles has been exploring the world of Japanese rock with us lately. Today he considers the lingering effects of punk rock on Japanese music.
Part of punk rock's assault in the late 70s was a bitter, ironic commentary on the topsy-turvy world mass media has shaped. In pop music, alienation from modernity proved to be almost as catchy as teenage rebellion and free love. So most industrialized countries developed some kind of punk rock underground. Japan was no exception, but about the only Japanese punk rockers to get a hearing in the West were the Plastics. They lasted from about 1979 to 1981. The visual focus of the band was the impassive, spiny-haired female vocalist Chika. But the mastermind was guitarist and songwriter Hajime Tachibana. The jittery, fractured rhythms of his songs and his strangled vocals obviously drew on new wave bands like Talking Heads and Devo. If you want to put some silly Devo fan in his place, you can sneer that the Plastics were what Devo would have been like without their sophomoric smugness. If you can find the Plastics' second album, called Oragato Plastico, in an import bin, it really can stand with early work by Talking Heads. This is a song about a fellow so obsessed with the myriad art trends pressing in on him that he ignores his passionate girlfriend.
From Marisa to Bauhaus, from Russian avant-garde, Peter Viet to Marlin, problems of shimmerlice.
To me, the Japanese performers that most directly descend from the Plastics are the two women who comprise the Frank Chickens, Kazuko Hoki and Atsuko Kimura. Now, Frank Chickens are going to seem rather impure examples of Japanese performers to some people. Like the Plastics, they sing mostly in English, but they live in England, not Japan, and don't play any instruments themselves. Nevertheless, Frank Chickens and their British collaborators use new-wave electro-dance beats not unlike the Plastics, and their songs often grapple with the tensions of cultures in high-speed transition. More than anyone else, the Frank Chickens are very frank about the stereotypes applied to Japanese women everywhere they go.
I'm a Japanese girl. I'm guilty, I'm innocent. Japanese girl. She has the beauty of mystery and violence. Sugared with patience, smelling like sun. Sometimes I dream of being like that. My basket was full of plastic innocence.
Hoki and Kimura never forget they are punk rebels, though. While tunes like You Say, We Say draw half-friendly parallels between Eastern and Western colloquial expressions, Frank Chickens excel at aggressive sarcasm, as in this caustic view of England called Yellow Toast. The Frank Chickens' most complex and varied album is Club Monkey from 1988. Sometimes it's hard to tell exactly what's going on in a song, since the lyrics tend toward the obscure. Apparently, Frank Chickens are spinning a postmodern legend about Club Monkey, with its frivolous, confused patrons and their encounters with ancestral ghosts, sexy and edible dogs, kung fu heroines, and ominous gods. The scenery grows ever more sinister. Frank Chickens lead us through a landscape in which the old is not just giving way to the new, but in which the ancient and the futuristic interpenetrate in a nightmarish jumble. In the music, country and western accordion plays tag with cybernetic funk synthesizers. Frank chickens are funny, peculiar, and not easy to get used to. But in a metaphor I'm sure they would like, I can say Hoki and Kimura are like fresh sushi. One good bite and you might get hooked.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice.
We are ninjas, locatious. That's not what you expect. I can fly as high as Fujiyama.
This is Fresh Air. You can get a sense of Ben Vaughan's humor from some of his song titles, like I Feel Like Jerry Lewis in France, and I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee. And from his music, you can hear his immersion in the roots of rock and roll. Vaughan is a songwriter, singer, guitarist, and inveterate record collector. He recently spent time in Capitol's record vaults producing a reissue of sessions by rhythm and blues man Johnny Otis. Ben Vaughan grew up in Camden, across the river from Philadelphia. Ben Vaughan's fourth album, Dressed in Black, was released this week. The album features guest appearances by John Hiatt and Marshall Crenshaw. Alex Chilton, formerly of the Box Tops, sits in on piano on this track, Hey Romeo.
One, two, one, two, three.
Hey Romeo,
what are you gonna do?
Hey Romeo,
now that she's leaving you.
Never thought she'd leave a man like you.
Hey Romeo,
you better face the facts.
Hey Romeo,
she won't be coming back.
Hey Romeo,
this is the final act. The train she's a riding's heading down the track.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Romeo.
Songs you write are inspired by rock and roll of the 1950s and 1960s. Is it because that was the period you grew up in, or is it something else about the music?
Well, I started listening to AM radio, I guess it was in about 1964 when the Beatles came out. But I quickly caught up with Chuck Berry and Everly Brothers and New Orleans music and R&B and everything that came before, just because I had to know where this came from, where rock and roll started. So I kind of started looking back at a very young age.
Who helped you look back? Did you just go to the record stores and buy things?
No, I had an uncle who was kind of a delinquent. at least my mother told me he was anyway. And he kind of sat around the house and he did odd jobs for cigarette money and everything. And he would just buy rock and roll records and play them for me.
When you're writing a song that's inspired in part by some earlier music, where do you draw the line between stealing a line and paying homage to a favorite record?
What I do is I put the records out, and if anybody wants to sue me, they can contact me. That's how I feel about it. No, I think that I draw on it as reference material, and then I'm writing a song, and I just happen to place it in the style that I like at that time or whatever.
I want to play some of Too Sensitive for This World. Did this start out as a serious song or a satirical song?
It started out as a title that I got, and when I got the title, I thought, wow, that's a great title. You know, I'm going to have to write a song with that. And then I didn't do anything with it for about a year, and then the song itself is serious, but the title is potentially funny. You know, it's like I have a tradition of that. I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee has the same thing, and there's a few others that are basically disguised. It's a very serious song, though.
Every day starts with a broken heart. I must be too sensitive for this world. Well, I know it ain't right to cry every night. I'm
sensitive for this world.
And the world is such a callous place. It's a wonder. Survive.
What came first for you, writing or singing?
Writing. I reluctantly became a singer just to basically pitch my songs to other people. That was the intention all along. You know, I was hoping to get other people to do my songs so I could sit around the house, you know, get a royalty check and, you know, sit on the porch.
No such luck, huh?
Nah. I'm working hard now.
So what do you think of your voice? You were reluctant to sing.
Well, I don't mind it so much. You know, it's kind of in the vein of like Johnny Cash or Neil Diamond or somebody like that where, you know, they don't have great voices, but you know it's them. It's a distinctive style, and it's got my personality stamped all over it. And so it represents me and who I am.
Now, I read that you didn't make a living with your music till you were around 27.
Even then, I was still working.
What kind of work did you do up until then?
Well, I got out of high school and I didn't go to college. I got a job at a knitting mill and did that for a while. And then I worked in a factory on an assembly line. And then I was a landscaper, which is basically a glorified term for mowing lawns. I did that for 3 years. And with no sign or hope of getting out of it either, it wasn't like a summer job for me where, you know, I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. Man, that was my lot in life as far as I knew. So I was writing songs that whole time, not showing them to anyone and not really believing myself that they might be any good. I was just doing it to satisfy myself. And I think that really most of my songs wouldn't be possible if I hadn't lived as a total nobody for as long as I did.
You have this great song on your first album called Wrong Haircut,
mm-hmm.
about someone who keeps getting shut out of things because he's got the wrong haircut. What inspired that song?
The New York club scene. In 83, the Combo did a show at Danceteria, which was it's like Satyricon, you know. all these different levels of strange behavior and a very elitist behavior. And I was wandering around before I went on, and there's an elevator. So I waited for the elevator because I wanted to go to one of the other floors and see what was going on. And the elevator door opened, and there was a black girl with a blue mohawk running the elevator. And she just looked at me and shook her head no and closed the door and wouldn't even let me on.
Oh, she was one of the guards?
Yeah, she worked there, you know. And it just seemed to me like I got this whole vision of there someday being a haircut police, you know.
When I got to the club, I was ready to rock. The music stopped. Uh-oh, wrong haircut. Well, the music went back on and the people resumed. So I tried to look cool as I walked around the room. Well, I sat down next to a girl with way out hair. I started talking about art to prove I ain't no square. Drink and she threw it in my lap. Uh-oh, wrong haircut.
Do you think that the rock scene has gotten any less elitist in terms of you have to look right and behave right and know the right people to get into the clubs?
Well, I don't know about clubs so much, but now with videos has basically changed rock and roll. And hair is more important than it ever was now. You know, if you watch MTV, you know, hair is very important. If you don't have the right hair, or worse off, if you have no hair, forget it, you know, unless you shave your head. But it's a very important thing now, so I think it's pretty much the same.
How would we describe your hair?
Unkempt.
Yeah, right. Guess that'll about sum it up. When you look ahead, what kind of future do you see for yourself as a performer? I mean, I call it cynicism, but I just have a feeling that someone as quirky as you probably wouldn't be, you know, like the kind of big star,
mm-hmm.
maybe not get to like even the major label. And it's possible if you did that they wouldn't pay enough attention to make it really matter. Do you know what I mean? There's
Well, I look at this all as an experiment that I started when I decided that I really didn't want a day job anymore. I'm already a success. I don't have a day job. I'm still amazed by that. Every morning I wake up and realize I don't have to get in my car and drive to some factory, or you know, office or anything like that. I realize that what I'm doing has saved me, and that I'm already successful enough. And I'm, like I said, it's like an experiment. Like I'll take it as far as I can take it, but I'm really not setting goals for myself that are leaving me frustrated now, or could leave me frustrated. I think that would be very stupid.
You know, you've listened to a lot of rhythm and blues and jazz over the years, and in both of those musics, there was a history of people of all ages playing it. You didn't have to worry, like, when you got over 30, when you got over 40, mm-hmm. what future would you have in music? Has that given you, do you think, a different perspective on, you know, on your future in music than, say, some people who only know rock and roll and have always thought of this, like, age crisis?
Yeah, I really do think so. I think that I have some records by people like Johnny Hodges and Duke Ellington where their playing got better when they got into their 50s or 60s, you know. And it was just, they kept doing it, and they just kept getting better and better and better. Yeah, I think that it's, I can see myself doing this for a real long time.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Ben Vaughan's new record, Dressed in Black, is on Enigma Records. This is The Man Who Has Everything.
Every year when you buy your Christmas gifts, there's always one name left on the bottom of your list. Well, you can search and search in every store, but you won't find nothing that I ain't had before. Cause I'm the man.
He's the man who has everything.
I'm the man.
He's the man who has everything.
Yes, I am.
He's the man who has everything for you.
No, I don't have you. I got a rhinestone bathtub that's filled with champagne on the first class section of my own private plane. I got a full-time tailor, keep on working all day, cause I wear my clothes once and then I throw them away. Yes, I'm the man.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what are you doing on the anniversary of Terry Anderson's capture?
We have sent Noah Adams down to the demonstration, which takes place in front of the White House, just across the street. The president had some things to say. We have several stories on the hostages. We also are taking a look at the political campaign, which is taking place now in East Germany. That election is on Sunday. Estonia is back. We're talking about Estonia again as the Baltics try to make decisions about secession. And education in Mississippi and Irish music, all kinds of things, Terry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Timothy O'Grady is a writer who was born and raised in Chicago, then lived in Ireland, and now resides in London. His novel, Motherland, reflects on Ireland. It won England's David Higham Prize for Best First Novel last year, and it's just been published here. Critic Maureen Corrigan says it's a good read for St. Patrick's Day.
Forget the parades, the green beer, and those plastic leprechaun hats. They're for the tourists and the silly Irish. We brooding Irish Americans celebrate St. Patrick's Day by breaking open a bottle of good whiskey, singing some gloomy ballads, and telling sad stories about the old country, even if we've never been there. The annual St. Patrick's Day story in my family that was guaranteed to have everyone crying into their corned beef and cabbage had to do with a distant cousin named Thomas. As the story goes, Thomas yearned to escape from the ancestral peat farm and joined the waves of immigrants hoping to find 3 square meals a day in America. After years of saving, he was finally able to book passage on a grand new ship, the Titanic. Cousin Thomas's second mistake was to travel steerage class. Most of those passengers were locked below decks to prevent them from joining the aristocratic lunge for the lifeboats. So much for the luck of the Irish. If you don't have any Celtic calamities of your own to dwell on this St. Patrick's Day, try reading Timothy O'Grady's novel, Motherland. O'Grady captures the rueful humor essential to any great Irish yarn. He also manages to combine a meditation on 800 years of Irish history with a detective story. Motherland's unnamed narrator is overweight, 40 and suffering from a severe Oedipal complex. When the novel opens, he's returned to his mother's apartment in Dublin to find that she's disappeared. She's left behind a pet monkey and a book with heavy vellum pages dating from the 12th century to the present. With the monkey as a companion and the book as a guide, the narrator sets off across Ireland to find his mother. For the first few chapters, I was worried that Motherland was going to be another one of those tiresome novels where eccentric characters just roam around encountering other eccentric characters. But once the narrator begins to decode the manuscript and shifts our focus to the past, the novel becomes hypnotic. O'Grady conjures up the terrible beauty of the ancient Gaelic world, its stark landscapes, glorious artwork, and ritualized violence. This journey into the deep past is motivated not only by the narrator's search for his mother, but by the politics of the motherland, Ireland. O'Grady wants to locate the origins of Ireland's troubled history, a history that he implies has reached its lowest point in the 20th century with the union with England. "The union," one character cries, "you may as well marry a hyena to a swan. They turn everything to carrion. They sucked out our blood and siphoned it into their own island. What's become of us? A waterlogged grazing ground for absentee landlords. A European capital become provincial backwater." O'Grady's critique of contemporary Ireland is as powerful as his idealized visions of its golden age. Motherland has a happier ending than the story of Cousin Thomas and the iceberg, but just barely. This is a novel about Ireland, after all.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Timothy O'Grady's novel, Motherland. It's published by Henry Holt. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sharrock are our production assistants. And we say thanks and farewell to our researcher, Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Noel Pearson and Jim Sheridan, the producer and director of My Left Foot. It's their first movie, but it earned Oscar nominations for Best Director and Best Picture. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews the new reissue, Coltrane Live at Birdland. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.